My name is Tyler.
And my name is Oren.
Welcome to the Horror Podcast. Those of you that are joining us for the first time, or if you're regular attendance here, will be familiar with our format, which is typically the podcast is broken up into three segments. The first segment, Oren and I will kind of talk to you about what's going on in the horror world, what we're excited about. The middle part, we'll try to answer the essential question. We never do, but we will sadly make an attempt this time around.
Yeah, and we'll just talk about the movie in general.
Yeah, give you some background in case you're curious or you want to see some familiar stuff or similar stuff. And then third and finally, we will give you some movie recommendations that will hopefully play really well with Insidious, give you the same kind of tenor and tone and vibe. So with no further ado, next slide, please.
And before we get too far, thank you all for coming out and sticking around. It's been great to have everybody.
Yeah, we've got a pretty good crowd tonight, and we're starting to see some faces show up on a regular basis, which is awesome. So thanks so much for coming here and trying to beat the heat as best you can.
It's nice
to
hear.
You posted on Twitter like a week ago this particular box set, this Mexican macabre that is one of the things you're excited about. Talk to me about what that is and where it's coming from and all that.
So, the Mexico Macabre set from Indicator, it just came out. I got mine, like I said, like you said, about a week ago. Indicator is a Blu-ray label from Britain, but most of their discs are region-free, so you can watch them here in the States, and these are all region-free. And this set is like four Mexican horror movies from the 50s and 60s. So the earliest one, I think, is 59. The latest one, I think, is 63. But they are... they're great. Like... I love these old Mexican horror movies from the 50s and 60s. They're delightful movies. But more to the point, in this case, they've been relatively hard to get. Like, most of these were only released on Casa Negra, which was a DVD imprint that went out of print, so most of them are unavailable. You can find them on, like, YouTube rips or something sometimes, but, like, to find a good copy has been really hard for most of these. And so it's been really great to, like, get four of them in, you know, pristine Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Nice restorations.
Well, and there is, I've got a long going love affair with like the kind of 50s and 60s Mexican horror films, mostly because the Morbido Horror Film Festival is based off of out of Mexico City. And they came and did a very special presentation at Fantastic Fest where they just went through the history of both pro wrestling and horror films and the intersection of the two. It was fascinating. It was super interesting. So, I'm really excited to check out Mexican Macabre.
We're definitely going to feature something from it here at some point because I'm really excited.
So. Yeah, it's cool stuff. All right, A Corpse for Christmas.
So, for everybody who's here, if you want to come out, in about a week on Sunday, July 7th. It won't be here. It's actually at the Rewind Dive Bar that's underneath the Screenland. Every month, Elijah La Follette, he runs Magnetic Magic Rentals, which is a VHS distribution thing, and he programs a movie that he plays off VHS that we all watch and hang out. And this one's really special because the director is actually going to be there for this one.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so...
I know nothing about A Corpse for Christmas. But
I know nothing about it either, actually.
I will show up and talk to a director about it.
Yeah, it's shot on video, so that's cool, and it'll be fun.
Yeah, and Eli's a fan of the pod and sometimes here, so we will go out and do whatever we can for him. So the things I'm excited about. Number one is a film that came out last week called The Blackening, which is an African-American horror film starring African-American actors, pretty much everybody involved in the making of the movie, from the production, from the post-production, to the funding, is African-American. And as a result, I think it is a film that occupies a really special place, that it can critique the horror genre, but in an incredibly, playful way. I took my son to the critic screening, and he's 16 and really hard to impress. And we laughed the longest and the hardest we ever have. So I'm begging all of you. It's still out in theaters. I want it to do well. Go check out The Blackening. I think it's really smart and pretty awesome.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good stuff.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So totally worth it. And then this is kind of my shameless, guilty pleasure here. Yellowjackets Season 2 came out on Showtime. It is fantastic. The cast is bonkers. It is, as we will get into when we start talking about Insidious, just a big, weird, like, oeuvre or vibe or something, right? And it leans into that weird folk horror thing that it's going for in Season 1. And we just celebrated Folk Horror Month here at Stray Cat, so no better way to round it out than to check out Season 2 of Yellowjacket. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Next. All right. Here is also one last shameless plug. We are really excited at Signal Horizon to present Camp Drinkaway, which is our pop-up bar that we are co-hosting with the Big Rip Brewing Company. And it's going to be the whole kind of backspace that they have there. It's going to be interactive. You can play as your favorite archetype. So if you've ever wanted to be the nerd, I live that life on a regular basis. So I might pick the jock or the final girl or something like that. But you can play your way through the entire pop-up. Or if you just want to sit around and drink beer and look at really cool shit from a slasher perspective, you can absolutely do that too. So keep that in your ears and in your mind as we get closer to Halloween.
Because that's going to be the whole month of October, right?
Whole month of October. Yeah. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There will be two different show times, essentially, that you can come and partake. So, yeah, it's totally awesome. You can find the event on Eventbrite, but it'll be all over your socials if you are into the horror scene. Yeah. So, All right. Next slide.
All right. So before we get too far, we're going to do our first giveaway.
Yeah.
Let's do this one first.
Okay, perfect.
So we're going to give away a VHS copy of Godzilla, which is very thematic. A book to test your ESP, which includes seeing if your pets have ESP. And a DVD copy of 13 Ghosts.
I like it. That copy of 13 Ghosts is great.
Yeah, I like that. I found that somewhere. God knows. Last three numbers are 041.
Yay!
Awesome.
Okay,
throw it back in there. All right.
Congrats. There you go. I think that copy of 13 Ghosts has, one of the special features, if I remember correctly, is you can, click on one of the ghosts, and it gives you, this...
Oh, yeah, their backstory. Yeah. Yep.
In a really creepy fashion.
They did this really elaborate backstory for all of them.
Yeah, I dig it. All right, next slide. As we will transition into our essential question for tonight... What does Insidious get right about astral projection?
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Sweetie?
Morning, guys.
He's not in a coma. They don't know what to call it. There was something in there with him. I know someone who can help.
We took Trifield and EMF readings of the whole house. Wiring, alarm clocks.
I don't think bad wiring is the problem here.
I want to leave. I want to leave this house.
What is it?
It's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
Trailer. Okay, Oren, as we move on to the next slide, I always kind of ask, why did you pick this film? What intrigued you about it? And I will probably also ask that you elaborate some on, like, this is a newer film, and you most always pick something that's older.
I mean, I try to mix it up some. I try to throw you a bone once in a while.
So why Insidious?
So we picked Insidious this time because the new one's coming out in a week. Like, I'm excited because the new one's going to have the lipstick demon, who has a name. We'll get to that in a minute. But it's going to have him back, and that's great. We were talking last time, I think, whenever I was programming this, and talking about the new Insidious coming out and everything, and we were just like, well, have we ever done Insidious? And it turned out we had not. So we're like, well, we should. And basically that was it.
I gotta tell you, this is this film and the Conjuring films, and there is, and I'm blinking on the name now, a film that came out at the same time, Sinister. They all kind of came out, and in my mind, they blend together, right?
Yeah.
So when you were like Insidious, I'm like, oh yeah, the weird one where the, you know, the demon makes snuff films. I'm like, that was not that film.
No.
This is this film.
Yes.
And I think probably a superior film for a variety of reasons, not the least of which, like, the budget on it was freaking tiny,
no.
Right?
Well, we're jumping around. No,
we'll,
you can go
we'll
back.
Get there.
one of the things that gets forgotten about Insidious because of movies like The Conjuring and Sinister and the fact that Insidious was a big hit is that it was actually an independent film when it was made. It was not financed by a big studio. This was between... So James Wan obviously made Saw, which is kind of where he hit big from, which was an indie film. And then after that, he made a couple of studio films, which didn't do very well. One of them was Dead Silence, which I love, but it did not do well. And so when he tried to go back to doing horror, doing something different to try and break out of all that, he went with another independent film, which had a very small budget, a very short shooting time, and... was actually based on an idea that he and Leigh Whannell, who also worked together on Saw, had back when they were in film school. So it was kind of a return to indie filmmaking, which it doesn't really feel like it. It feels like it's a much bigger...
Pretty big budget, honestly.
Juan has always been able to pull a lot from a budget. Like, his movies do not look like they cost what they cost, typically. It was made for a relatively small budget of about $1.5 million and made about $100 million in the box office. So it was a huge hit, which spawned both a franchise, which now we can see the franchise up here on the screen here, but also, a number of imitators and kicked, James Wan into sort of being a big horror filmmaker, made The Conjuring, which made even more money, and so on and so forth.
Well, and it also helped jettison Leigh Whannell into everything that we have seen him do, right?
Yeah.
Most importantly, probably, would be The Invisible Man. That's the thing that everybody saw. Fantastic film. And then before then, he did this kind of weird science fiction movie.
Upgrade.
That I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Way different, I think, in kind of vibe and sentimentality than all this other stuff. But this is like a proof of concept. And if you were paying attention during the opening credits, you'll notice one of the biggest backers, the first person to put up money, was Jason Blum.
Right.
Before Blumhouse became the giant thing that it was.
I mean, in the same way that New Line was the house that Freddy built, as they called it, Blumhouse is, to no small extent, the house that Insidious built. Like, the success of Insidious launched Blumhouse and all of the... things that came from that to no small extent.
And I'm left with the reality. I was reading about Disney just losing hands, like over fist in cash, like over $1 billion, I think, this last year. And it's just bleeding cash. And most of it comes from really high budget, high concept, movies, right? Yeah. Like Marvel movies or animated movies or whatever. But you're spending, you know, $100 million to make a movie, then you've got to really be doing something right to make that back.
Right.
When you're writing a check for $750,000 or $1 million, you know, then your threshold of getting over that is really low.
Yeah.
And you would think, you know, studios, as they start to tighten budgets, would be like, oh, shit, we can make a killing by maybe not making another Insidious movie, but making a movie like Insidious.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that comes down to it, like, when you make a really big movie, like any Avengers movie or whatever, it's going to make a shit ton of money. But it's going to make, you know, it cost a shit ton of money as well. So it's going to make a few times its budget, right? Like maybe 10 or something in most cases. But you look at Insidious, it made literally 100 times its budget. And so, you know, it's hard to do that when your budget is hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Like there's no real way to make 100 times that in any realistic world.
Well, and it's risk-reward, right? Like, studios got lots of million-dollar ideas, right?
Right.
Probably only have 100 million idea that they can try to bust the bank with. And if it doesn't work out, then, you know, we're exactly where we are if you were on Disney's board.
Yeah.
Which I am not. I'm easily
poor. Oh, I thought you were.
School teacher, yeah. But
clearly this movie shows that if you're a measly school teacher, you can live in a palatial house.
I know, right. Two of them, right?
Like, right? Like, yeah.
There's like no conversation about like, how are we going to sell this home? How are we? It's just like, oh, yeah. Magic.
I'd never noticed before, they were leasing. That helps a little.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. They found a place they can afford too. At some point in time, I'm going to write a book about the portrayal of teachers in horror movies because they're either the villains, right? They're these awful, you know, whatever. Or when they're the heroes, they're often presented in this way that they're like, you know, the deficiency of the lifestyle, right? The fact that they don't have any money is often, you know, kind of magic wand waved over, right? Because I don't think she's working, right? The wife doesn't have a job.
She's apparently a songwriter, but I don't think she's, you know, like, doing it heavily right now.
Right, right. She just keeps writing Tiny Tim lyrics.
Like, in the sequel, we do see, and a little bit in this one, we see the house that Patrick Wilson's character grew up in with his mom, a single mom, and it is even bigger. So obviously he comes from money of some sort, right? Like there's no other explanation for any of this than that Patrick Wilson's character has some money.
Yeah, I think that that is at least an explanation. I will take it. You know, mom's got some money to add to him. I will ask the question, have you seen all of the Insidious
films? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Very good. I don't think I have seen Insidious Chapter 3. I have seen The Last Key, and The Last Key made about as much sense, I think, as if I would have seen Chapter 3.
So. I mean, I feel like you probably needed to see 3 to make much sense of The Last Key, but okay. So the first one's the one we just watched. Hopefully it's fresh in everyone's mind. Chapter 2 picks up literally right where this one ended.
Right.
And in Chapter 2, the primary conflict is that Patrick Wilson's character is possessed by the bright and black ghost. 3 then, though, like the end of 2 resolves the Lambert family's story, and they're gone from then on. Until 5. 5's apparently going to pick them back up, which is exciting for me. And Patrick Wilson's directing it in his debut, which is also interesting.
Interesting.
Less
confidence.
We'll see how that goes. I mean, yeah, you know, maybe it'll be great.
We're going to give everybody a chance.
3 is a prequel that tells how Elise and Specs and Tucker meet.
Nice, yeah.
And then 4 is another prequel that picks up where 3 left off.
Okay.
So that's why it didn't make any sense, is because it's literally a direct sequel to the movie you didn't watch.
All right, that's fair then. I will say, though, right, the number one takeaway I got from this film, especially later on, was that Elise and those two were, like, they stole every scene that they were in, right? They were funny. They were the kind of way that we could take off from all of that tension. And, of course, you know, Elise has now become, I think, an iconic horror.
Yeah, Elise is a delight. She's great.
She's superb.
It's really great to have Elise as essentially our hero character, because it's great to see an older
absolutely.
Actor getting to take on such a prominent role throughout, and she becomes again the main character in 3 and 4. And it's great to see her get to do that. You know, that's fantastic. And it's a thing we do not get in movies like this very often.
Yeah.
You know, movies of this type are honestly usually like teenagers are the protagonists.
One of the things that struck me about this film is that there is an absence, I think, of that kind of male gaze that sometimes dominates particular parts of horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Every time that we see the wife, especially even when she's in bed, she wears sensible pajamas, you know? Yeah. They are comfortable. They are the things that normal people wear, right? So I think Juan is working really hard to not fall into some of those traps, and that makes Elise, I think, even better, right?
As it's great.
A woman with agency, for sure. Yeah. Now, all of this leads us to your favorite term, which is elevated horror.
Yes.
You want to talk to us as we move to the next
slide?
Yeah,
okay. So, so when I was doing some research for the episode, which I try and actually do a little bit of before I show up here and just jabber...
I appreciate that somebody is that.
I ran into a article on Looper from a writer who was arguing that Insidious was actually the first elevated horror movie before that term was coined. Around the time The Witch came out is when the term was coined.
Yeah.
And you know, the elevated horror people would fucking hate that. Like they hate this movie as a rule.
Yeah.
Like But, you know, he made this argument that, you know, that the film did a number of the things that the elevated horror films that followed it would do, which was things like focus on adult characters, build its story around a domestic drama, essentially, of things that could potentially happen to real people, things like...
astral projection.
Like having a child who was ill,
sure.
Having to deal with that. You know, having conflict within your marriage because one of you is handling it one way and the other one is not handling it,
right?
And things like that. And I
grading
found
papers until at 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
Come on, man.
And I did find an interview with James Wan himself, who described it as an adult drama thrown into a haunted house, which he did back in 2011, which was, of course, again, years before we started having this conversation about elevated horror, which is essentially always just an adult drama with horror stuff thrown into it.
Yeah. No, and I think it is interesting to look through that lens, right, for a couple of reasons. Number one, as a precursor to elevated horror, one of the things that you and I have talked about many a time, either in a car ride or on the pod or whatever, is that elevated horror, right, or the films that we think fit into that label now, or label themselves that way, tend to be a drag, man. Like, they are just, they're hard to get through sometimes. They're scary, right? Like, they're fantastic films, but they're not a lot of fun. I think this film manages to bring in the kind of fun part of horror into that domestic drama, and that's why I think we like the film so much, right?
Absolutely. I like this better than pretty much any movie that is actually classed as elevated horror, like, because I like movies that are fun. And I like movies that are stupid, and this one's occasionally a little bit stupid. But it's pretty good at it, is the thing. Like, James Wan never has big pretensions for what he's doing, but he's pretty good at what he's doing almost all the time. He builds good jump scares. He doesn't misuse the jump scares, by which I mean the jump scares are always real. They're not fake outs. There's never a jump scare that's not an actual thing happening.
Yeah.
There's never the equivalent of a cat jumping out or something. And so, like, it works better than most of the jump scare movies that it gave rise to.
Yeah.
So.
And I'll look it up and I'll stick it in the show notes. But that idea, right, and especially in this viewing with a good crowd that you can hear folks, you know, respond to some of those jump scares. Not only are they real, but they act as that kind of catharsis, right? That punctuation of tension, right? And when you have so many fake outs, when you do so many different things, you never get that. So every jump scare is both scary and also gives us a place to reset from, right?
Yeah.
And that, I think, is pretty damn remarkable
yeah.
for a film that is as strange, especially in the third act, right?
Yeah.
Because the first two acts feel very haunted housey,
yeah.
very normal, and then it's like, let's spend the whole third act in a completely different place. Buckle up. As we move to the next slide, I think you captured a really good one, a really good quotation. Yeah.
So, yeah.
This is James Wan talking about it.
Yeah. So I was trying to find, which I'll get to it a little bit more in a minute, but I was trying to find a tweet James Wan did at one point where he basically said why this movie was weirder than all the ones that followed it. So if you've seen the other Insidious movies, if you've seen the Conjuring movies, none of them go as far as this movie goes with their strange shit. The Further doesn't look as weird in the subsequent movies. There's no lipstick demon. They look more like normal ghosts. And I could not find the tweet, but I did find a quote where Wan said that, you know, with the first Insidious movie, people love the first two-thirds, and they'll kind of go, oh, yeah, with the end, where it kind of goes in a different direction and becomes this other thing. And in the tweet I was looking for, he points to that and says, you know, look, we made Insidious and it was a big hit, but audiences didn't like the last third. So from then on, whenever we tried to get financing, we had to basically not be as weird. And you can see him not being as weird for years, and then he gets enough money and clout, and then he makes Malignant.
Yeah.
Where he's super fucking weird.
Right.
Like, he clearly wanted to be all along.
Yep. Well, and I think that's what makes this film so unique, right? As we put together the slideshow, we always kind of talk back and forth on the Slack channel about some things that we felt were important. And one of the things that struck me is the lighting design of this film is so rad, right?
Yeah.
Like, there is so very little normal sunlight that you see, right? Like, even during broad daylight, you have this weird blue filter that makes everything feel like a dream, makes it feel ethereal or something else, right?
And it's a thing where it gets more that way as it goes along. Like you said, the first third, it's relatively normal. The second third, it gets more, like, everything ramps up, the lighting gets weirder. By the last third, the lighting's just fucked. Like, it's not at all natural. There's no natural light, essentially, in the last third of the movie. It's all, like, weird blue lanterns and, you know, red-lit hallways and all this different stuff, and it's great.
But it looks great, and, like, I don't know how they did it, but the kind of, when they're walking in the ether, right, when they're walking in the Further, right, somehow all of that darkness seems to leach away from that lantern, right?
Yeah.
And it, like, only, you know, lights up his face. Everything else is kind of eaten up by that.
Yeah.
And I think it's remarkable that he was able to do it, but also goes to just how weird that final act is. So, yeah, long story short, as we move to the next slide, that's why we don't get any more weird shit, man. Because people are like...
That's why we had to wait a decade and a hand change for Malignant, like...
Yeah.
People just didn't appreciate weird shit when they got it.
It's kind of like he just stuck all that, like, and just let it brew up, you know? He just let it ferment. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to make a weird Siamese twin movie because I can't make the sequel to Insidious that I really wanted to make. So, yeah, man. I think what we can take from this is if you like things that are weird, if you like things that are a little different, you should try to support it as best you can. So,
yeah.
Next slide, please. Okay, talk to us a little bit about the mythology surrounding Insidious.
Okay, so ostensibly, we are going to answer a question here in a minute about astral projection and Insidious's portrayal thereof. So we're going to
talk. Mark it down. We're going to answer the essential question.
Sure, we are.
All
right. But first, we need to talk a little bit about, like, the sort of mythology that Insidious sets up, which essentially has two points, which is the first point being the whole astral projection thing, and the Further, which is that some people can project out of their bodies and go to this place that they call the Further, where dead people and apparently, like, weird disembodied spirits go.
Yeah. Demons. Yeah.
And so, like, it's key to understanding what's going on that there are both ghosts, with, like, the Bright and Black or literally all the other things that show up are ghosts. And then there are also these things that were never alive. Like the demon, the lipstick demon, which actually is the man with fire on his face. And that gets echoed in the Conjuring films as well, which is one of the reasons these films feel similar to one another, besides that James Wan made them both, is that this mythology is very similar to the mythology that the Warrens sort of used to explain the hauntings they supposedly investigated, which was that there were both the spirits of the dead people and also spirits that had never been alive, that they call demons. She also calls it a demon in this, but they are... whatever it is, it's not a person.
Right.
It never was.
It's a whole bad monster slash vibe that just wants to take over, right?
Yeah.
And I appreciate the world building that is done here, right?
Yeah.
Like, there, it makes some sense at least to throw a little bit of space and time at explaining where all these ghosts are coming from.
Yeah.
I also think it sometimes, and again, I love this film, makes the plot a little messy, right?
Because
we see all these kind of ghosty things, and like the ghost of the little boy, right? Is he bad? Is he good? Well, you know, what's going on? And I think the argument is he's really close to the, you know, the ghost world now, so they can enter our world a lot easier or whatever. But, you know, kind of takes away from the immediacy of the demon, which I think is probably the more compelling thing to examine, maybe? I don't know. Okay, so let's chat a little bit then as we move to the next slide. Astral projection, okay? I know a little bit about it. I know a lot more about it now that we prepared for this, but I feel like it was really popular when we were teenagers and has fallen a little bit out of favor as a result. But talk to us a little bit.
So apparently the idea back when Winnell and Juan were in film school and had this idea for this movie originally, they just wanted to do a movie about astral projection because they didn't think there had been one. There have been a few. But, you know, it was something that didn't get made a lot.
Sure.
So they were like, we should make a movie about astral projection. Sure, that seems cool. And partly that's, you know, because they're similar ages to us. And like you said, astral projection was kind of a big thing when we were younger and we were, you know, reading weird books about like UFO conspiracies and astral projection
ESP,
and ESP
and
shit like that, right?
Remember. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I didn't actually know much about it either until I did the digging for this. But actually, the movie's pretty close on most of what most of what I found. The idea of an out of body experience is one that goes like, I've got on the slide the year the term was coined, which was 1943, but the idea essentially has always existed, right? Like it's in a lot of belief systems, have variations on sort of mystical experiences or out of body experiences where you leave your body, you see other things, you can remote view, which is kind of a slightly different phenomenon, but you can see places that you aren't at, all these different things. So I broke down, you know, some of these sort of key elements that astral projection typically contains, because that's one of the things, right? Because it's in so many belief systems, it's not always the same.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't describe it the same way. Everybody doesn't believe the same things about it. So some of the, core tenets is that there's a thing that's called the subtle body or the spiritual body, the soul, whatever, the psyche. But it's not... it's not exactly like a soul, because a soul is separate from your body, and this is still tied to it.
It's like the 3D image of your...
Well, so it's actually... it's a way to solve the mind-body problem. And if you are not an idiot like me who studied philosophy in college, the mind-body problem is essentially, which is us? Are we our thoughts and our mind and our soul and our spirit or whatever, or are we the body we inhabit? Because there's no simple answer to this, right? You can get a ship of Theseus problem either way, where, you know, you replace parts or things change. Are you still you? How do you know? Et cetera, et cetera. So a way to sort of solve that division is this idea of a subtle body, which is both.
Yeah.
It is both your soul and your body. It's able to do things a soul can do, like travel places you can't go, et cetera, et cetera, but it's also tethered to your body still.
Right. a way to get back.
So what happens to your body happens to it. What happens to it happens to your body, et cetera, which you get a little bit of in the movie where the one dumb-looking ghost in the trench coat is kicking Patrick Wilson's ass and his body's getting its ass kicked.
He is real dumb-looking, though.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that ghost.
Like, that guy's not scaring anybody.
Like, I love this movie, but that ghost looks like a fucking dipshit.
Just run away from that guy. Like, what is that? Yeah. So what I found really interesting as we were gathering data about astral projection, like the idea of an astral plane is not particularly Western, right? Like there are tons of indigenous populations, especially here in North America and South America, that they don't talk about it like an astral plane, but they will talk about like out-of-body experiences as a result of taking like ayahuasca or, you know, another high-powered hallucinogen or whatever. But what I found really interesting, and the movie kind of hints at it here, like that realm, the further, right, pre-existed anything and everything. And the things that aren't ghosts, right, that Oren talked about earlier, demons and, you know, whatever else, are kind of like the original inhabitants of this place, right?
Right.
They've crafted rooms and houses and aesthetics, right? Like the fire demon's got a whole decorating vibe going on for him. And I found that both terrifying, right? Like, there is a place that, like, is so foreign to me that people have lived since the beginning of, you know, or things, people, have lived since the beginning of time. But also, like, have way more control over. So if I woke up there or I went there by accident, I'd be real fucked.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So there's an interesting thing. This is one of the only movies that really kind of almost gets here. There's an old Robert Westall story that Robert Westall was a British ghost story writer. He mostly wrote books for kids, but he wrote a number of ghost stories for adults, and they're real good. But he had this one particular ghost story where essentially he argues that anything a ghost can do, a person can do also, because a person is just a body with a ghost inside, right? So a person is, the word he uses is spooks plus.
I like it.
People are a ghost plus a body. That's better than a ghost. And we get a little bit of that here where, like, Elise reminds Patrick Wilson's character that he's alive and they're not. Like, he's stronger than them, even in the further. But that's not true of the demon, right? Like,
right.
The demon is more powerful, probably, than him, even in the further, because it's not less than it was before,
right?
The ghost is as a ghost minus a body now.
Yeah.
It's less than it was before, but the demon's not. It's all it ever was.
Yeah, and then, like, Fireface is scary, right?
You're right,
like,
yeah.
He's crazy. He's got this weird scorpion tail that I somehow missed in previous viewings. It's very good. So, here's my question as we move to the last slide here, not overall, but the last slide talking about astral projection. Is this movie, I think, a fair representation? Does it have an astral plane?
It does, definitely. It definitely has an astral plane. The astral plane, as it is typically described, is the place you pass through before you are born and the place you pass through after you die.
Oh.
But it's not the place you come from or the place you go. It's the place you pass through in between. So
that
people,
somehow makes it scarier.
People who can astrally project can just go there in like while they're still alive. But other people pass through it before they're alive and after they're dead.
Okay.
This one's like a spooky version of the astral plane.
I would
like,
have to imagine probably, even in your version, it sounds a little spooky to me. You know?
Like, I mean, it's supposed to not be bad, but, you know, whatever.
Maybe a little. How about subtle body?
It definitely has that. Obviously, you have the version of you that appears in the further,
right?
Which is separate from your physical body and can see it.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we get that great scene where you know, like, as we move into out of body, right?
Yep.
You like rise up, and I think we see that, right? There's clearly an out of body experience.
Yep.
I think the last thing I will say about out of body experiences, I think the modern vernacular, the modern popular culture, is we have out of body experiences when we die, which I think fits in with what you were talking about, you know, the astral plane being, I don't know, transformative or transitive or, you know, whatever. So
transitional, perhaps?
It was a word that
Probably the most interesting thing about this one, this one's version of the astral plane as opposed to the versions I was able to find doing my research, is that for budgetary reasons, almost certainly, this astral plane looks like the real world. Like, it looks like the physical plane.
with more fog.
With more fog and more creepy wax corpses. And I was originally said, and even in the notes I say, except the demon's lair, which is partly true. The demon has certainly redecorated his lair, but I realized only watching this time his demon's lair is inside their furnace.
Oh, that's great,
the
right?
The big grill where his door is the grill on their furnace, where that's his room so is the grill on their furnace. So
you do get the boy, right?
Yeah.
He is up in the attic, and he sees the furnace, and the furnace has flames in it, right?
Yeah,
and that's when everything bad kind of happens.
When they go back, the furnace isn't there. That's where the red door is.
Ah, so good.
It's just the scope has been drastically altered. Yeah. So the furnace is huge in the astral plane or whatever. So
very good. Okay, so here is... this is Oren's slide. I think it is fantastic. Talk to us about all of the fan work that surrounds James Wan, because you gave me some in the Slack channel, and then I did my own. And like, talk about a very deep hole that you could fall down and spend a great deal of time.
So I was looking for pictures to illustrate some of the slides and things for the show like I do, and I found just like a whole rabbit hole of specifically anime-style artwork, fan art of James Wan characters hanging out together. Which is the really cool thing, like, from different universes, which, again, in the picture I threw in here, which I couldn't find the artist for, we've got the demon from this movie, we've got the Annabelle demon, and we've got the nun from The Conjuring, but I also found, like, the puppet from Dead Silence and the puppet from Saw hanging out with the doll from The Conjuring, the Annabelle doll. I found, you know, all of the characters from The Conjuring series hanging out with one another and various other, like, horror characters. I did not find any Malignant yet, but I'm sure there is some.
Oh.
I am very excited to eventually find that.
I'm a little scared to go looking for fan art regarding Malignant.
But yeah, I mean...
get real weird real quick.
But yeah, there's a huge ton of specifically this anime-style fan art of all these characters hanging out together, which is a really... odd vibe, but I kind of like it.
Yeah. What was that? What is the term that was going through the horror community 2 or 3 weeks ago? Cozy horror, right? Like, it somehow makes this very cozy.
Yeah.
And
it's always the villains, too. Yeah. Like, there's some art of the heroes, but mostly it's like the demons and things, all just like chilling together.
Here's the bottom line. My spooky 7-year-old would 100% buy, like, a plushie of any of those things, right?
I am floored. There are no Funko Pops at all of any of the Insidious stuff.
Oh, wow.
There's a bunch for Conjuring, but none of the Insidious stuff, which I am shocked by.
So it's not a James Wan thing, right? It's not like him being like, I'm not going to do
that. No. There's a bunch for the Conjuring. I don't know why they never did any for the Insidious stuff. That's weird.
Shame on them.
I guess, right?
If you're listening to us.
And I kind of hate Funko Pops, but I'm just shocked there aren't any.
Yeah, well, and they like got bought and sold, and there's a lot of drama around
the whole thing. So. Yeah.
All right, it's time for a second giveaway.
Yes.
Second giveaway.
The second giveaway is exciting. We have another Blu-ray copy of Unwelcome. We gave some of those away last time.
Yay! It's great. It's got red caps in it. You should watch it.
We've got Haunted Ghost Stories, which includes 40 spine-tingling ghost stories. I cannot vouch for this.
I hope it's not just somebody reading the stories.
I have no idea. Like, there's pictures on the back.
Well, that's
encouraging. And then I have the Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown Psychic Voyages, if you want to learn more about astral projection.
I'm so excited. Like, he showed me the picture of the book. Like, that looks like one of those Time Life books. Yep. And it absolutely does.
It is. So. All right. So I've got to draw for this.
Do it. Do it.
All right. Last three digits are 043.
043.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, look at that. Go. Have fun with all those ghost stories.
Have fun learning about astral projection.
Next slide. All right. So here's the thing. I think this movie is a very specific aesthetic, a very specific message. What are the movies that you picked to go along with it? Let me be shocked that there is not a film that was made before or after 1970. And talk to us about it.
There never is. What are you talking about? So I picked... I actually juggled a few for my first one. I ended up going with The Black Pit of Dr. M, partly because it's one of the movies in that Mexico Macabre set.
Nice.
And so it was kind of fresh in my mind. It's a, again, Mexican movie from 1959 about these two doctors who make an oath. The first one of them who dies will find a way to contact the other one and bring them over to the other side and let them come back.
Like Harry Houdini kind of
style.
Yeah. I love it.
And so it has a lot of, you know, a lot of, like, dealing with the other side and seances and that kind of stuff in common with this. And then I picked The Nightwalker, a William Castle movie from 1964. And anybody who's listened for long knows I love William Castle movies. This one's not as gimmicky as some of his other ones, but it is basically about astral projection.
Cool.
It's about a woman who has dreams where she goes places and sees weird things that are actually really aesthetically similar to the things that he sees in this one. Like, really. I'm sure James Wan had seen it.
Cool. I'll have to check that out. Very good. Well, I picked the 2000 film The Cell. I think the idea of dream walking and, like, bizarre places that we visit and... I don't know, a monster that seems to be able to control his surroundings as much as he can control himself really appealed to me. Yeah. And then I like it's kind of a cop-out, but there are too many scenes where an older lady is telling somebody to walk towards her voice or listen to her voice or walk towards the light or,
It's essentially the same plot. Yeah. Like, the much has been made of the fact that this is essentially James Wan's Poltergeist. Like, the kid is the one that's haunted. There's all the same stuff. I mean, and James Wan has said it. I mean, like, it's not it's not a secret. Like, he's acknowledged it himself.
And so. I picked the 1982 one. Remake is fine.
I don't even remember the remake. I do not even remember it.
I try to not dog on movies too much, but if you're going to see a Poltergeist, see the 1982 version. Yeah. It's going to be better. All right, so let's talk about what we're going to show when we come back from break. The next slide. We always take July off. I teach a course at Truman State University called Monsters 101, which is essentially just a scary movie class. But I'm up there for 3 weeks, and we take that off to enjoy what little summer break we can get. And we come back out. But if you join us in August, what are we...
In August, we're going to watch The Haunted Palace from 60-something.
Okay, all right.
It's a Vincent Price movie. It's one of Roger Corman's Poe movies, ostensibly, hence the name being from a Poe poem. But it's actually the first cinematic adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Ah, that's why you picked it. I dig it. I'm ready for it. Very good. Well... we hope that you will join us then. We'll get the dates out on all the
it'll
socials.
It'll be the last Thursday in August, I believe.
Yep. So, Oren, where can they find more of your stuff? Final slide, please. On the internet.
I am Oren Gray, all the places I am, which is most of the places at this point. I'm still on Twitter, even as it burns down around me. I am.
You've been saying that every month now, right?
You know, eventually it'll go away, I guess. I'm on.
One can only hope.
I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Letterboxd if you want to see what movies I'm watching.
Yeah.
And I'm at orengray.com.
Very good. Well, you can always hit me up at Tyler at signalhorizon.com. That's where we're constantly writing reviews. Oren's got a couple of columns, a particularly great column about folk horror that I think actually speaks to Unwelcome, which we gave out here today.
Yeah.
So it's fantastic. Check out Signal Horizon. You can find me on Letterboxd. You can find me on Twitter, although I really try not to be there anymore. So, like, I will check it maybe once every couple weeks or whatever, and I am better for it. Yeah. So until then, class dismissed.